Is your pup in need of a trim? Or maybe a bath and de-shed are what your pup needs to feel clean and keep your carpets and furniture looking spick and span. Give Dee's Dog Grooming a call today at 509-325-0017. Located conveniently on Garland and Walnut. Again, Dee's Dog Grooming, 509-325-0017. Welcome to Spokane Valley Speaks, hosted by Al Merkel, where we give you the ins and outs of our city and its government to help you make the best decisions for today and for tomorrow. All right, welcome Spokane Valley listeners to another episode of Spokane Valley Speaks. And of course, any listeners who aren't in the valley, also welcome. Today, we are very lucky to be joined by another judge candidate, Mr. Eric Duyma, who is running for a district court judge position. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Duyma.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're really pleased to have these positions. As I've mentioned in some of the other positional interviews for this position, this is a hard one for voters in a lot of past and of course present elections, because it's a very important position, but you don't necessarily have that party backdrop that you would have in a lot of other positions to help people out. Of course, we'll talk about that here in a little bit, but I think the best place to start is really with your own description of what a district court judge would do, what you would do in that position. And, you know, how it's different than other types of judges.
Yeah, well, I guess I have the honor and privilege of serving as the district court commissioner. I was first appointed in June of 2018, so I kind of do the job right now. Gotcha. And so I kind of consider myself the floater. So the elected judges have assigned, dockets. They have assigned caseloads. And so they kind of stick to those caseloads. I'm the one that kind of floats around from courtroom to courtroom and covers pretty much everything that we do in district court. And so that's kind of my day to day. The difference between what I do and what the judges do is kind of just what I talked about. They have their assigned judges. We have four judges that are assigned for kind of the what we call the alpha court or the criminal dockets. And then the other four judges do some other miscellaneous things, first appearances, specialty courts, civil, and then protection orders are kind of what the other four judges do. And I, like I said, I have the privilege of doing all of those dockets. You know, every day I don't quite know what I'm covering sometimes until the last minute. Cause like I said, I kind of consider myself the floater. When I was first appointed back in 2018, we were actually short a judge. So I was given that assignment. So when I first came in 2018, I was, assigned to the civil, kind of the civil department. So that was what I did pretty much every day, until the two new judges came in, and then just became the ninth person on the court, basically. And so I think you'd asked a little bit about the differences in the courts. Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, it'd be great to know. I know a lot of listeners are often wondering, you know, district court, what is that versus superior court or, you know, Supreme Court? How are these positions different, I guess? What would you do in the position?
Yeah, in Spokane County, we have a handful of courts, actually. The city has its own municipal court. They handle traffic and criminal offenses. They don't do any civil stuff in muni court.
And about that, we're talking about the city of Spokane.
Yeah, city of Spokane. From other ones, right? Yep, and then Cheney has its own municipal court, and Airway Heights has its own municipal court. Within the county. And then we have district court. We're considered a court of limited jurisdiction. So we handle limited jurisdiction. So misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors on the criminal side. On the civil side, we do traffic. small claims and regular civil cases up to $100,000. In addition, we do, I wouldn't say a majority, but we do a lot of the protection order cases in Spokane County. District Court and Superior Court have concurrent jurisdiction on protection orders. And there are certain reasons that protection order cases have to go to Superior Court. And then, but the cases that don't have to go to Superior Court generally come to District Court. So we do a lot of the protection order cases.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess you kind of started to mention about this a little bit in your current role as commissioner. But I mean, you know, for our voting public, what kind of qualifications would they expect for a judge to have? What would you say a good summary of qualifications would be?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I think personality has a lot to do with it. I think a lot of varied life experience helps a lot. In my experience as an attorney, it seemed like the judges that I thought did the best job were always not always, but a lot of times were judges that had some other life experience outside of the law. I think a lot of attorneys, you know, the high school, college, law school attorney, there isn't a whole lot else in their lives. And I mean, I'm not saying that's bad, but that tends to happen a lot. I went to law school a little bit later in life. I had another kind of another, it seems like a lifetime ago, but kind of another life before that. And then in my legal career, I kind of did things on purpose because I knew someday I would maybe be here asking the voters to hire me for this type of job. Gotcha. And so as a lawyer, I picked out a lot of different types of cases. I didn't just do one thing. So I've handled pretty much everything that you can think of as a lawyer. I did a lot of criminal work for sure. But I also did a lot of other things. I practiced in pretty much every court in Eastern South Dakota. That's not true. Just around Spokane. I mean, the counties around Spokane. I practiced in tribal court quite a bit, both Spokane Tribal Court and Kalispell Tribal Court. So I think what I'm getting, the answer is I think just an attorney needs to have the broadest base of experience as they can. I think that helps. It helps you on the bench to know kind of what you're getting yourself into. I think a lot of judges had a very focused, I guess, legal practice. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it happens all the time. But I think when you're asking the voters to choose you, I think it's important for them to know that I've kind of been training for this position for a long time. As a lawyer and now as a judicial officer.
Gotcha. Well, you mentioned a little bit about a life before the law, so maybe you should tell us about that. What did you do before going to law school late in life? What was your life experience outside the court?
So I'll try to keep it as brief as I can. Sure. I don't want to tell you my life story, but I took a year off after high school. I always kind of say that I moved to Colorado with some friends of mine to be a ski bum. That's not totally true. I don't think I ever officially moved there, but I had some friends that did, and I pretty much stayed with them that whole first winter after high school. I'm from South Dakota. I grew up in South Dakota. Ended up coming back to go to college. I started college full time I kind of compare it to Whitworth. It's kind of a small liberal arts private school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. About three semesters in, I was racing motorcycles kind of as a hobby. That turned into a profession. And so I started going to college part time and racing motorbikes full time. I did that for about 6 years.
Are we talking about street racing here? Are we talking about
road racing? So, televised races, the whole nine yards. That's kind of,
and you were driving, you were actually riding, I guess you should say. Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of injuries. I think I've had, 11 surgeries maybe to fix things I've broken falling off motorcycles. I used to always say it was a hard way to try to make an easy living. I kind of came to the hard conclusion that I wasn't going to be rich and famous racing motorcycles at about the same time I was finally finishing up college, because I'd been going part-time while I was racing. I majored in chemistry and philosophy. So a couple of strange things. I'd always kind of thought I would go to medical school just because I had some friends that were doctors. But for some reason, when the time came to make that decision, I wasn't that interested. And so I didn't quite know what to do with my life. And, frankly, I didn't really want to get a job. So, I ended up going to law school. I think I maybe knew one lawyer before I started law school. It wasn't something, I didn't have family that was lawyers, or anything like that. But went from part-time college to full-time law school. So that was a little different, but, I've always liked school. I always did well in school. I think a lot of lawyers are probably in that boat. That's how they end up in law school. Traveled around racing motorbikes for about 6 years and then started law school after that. So it seems like it was kind of a dream or a lifetime ago at this point, but it happened. So it was a big part of my life. Prior to that, I had taken a job with, Gateway Computer Company. It used to be a big computer company.
For our younger listeners.
Yeah. When I worked there,
it was the one that looked like a cow, right?
Yep. And when I worked there, they had 25,000 employees in the United States.
It was like the third largest for a minute.
It was a big company. And I actually took that job so that I could try to make a little bit more money to finance the kind of the racing hobby at the time. I kind of realized I was good at racing kind of right away. I started winning, club level races pretty quickly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so just trying to figure out a way to make that into a business, which was very difficult. I'm literally racing against teams that have multi-million dollar budgets. And you show up with your bike and, your gas can, and you try to race against these guys. And, it's tough. It was easier to go club racing and try to make money, cause you could kind of chase purse money at club level races. And I was pretty good at that, but it was sure a lot of fun to go to the nationals and the televised races. Cause you're kind of treated like a rock star, and it was a lot of fun, but it was really hard to make any money. I had deals with some manufacturers and things, and they would pay you for performance. But, if your bike broke down or you crashed, you weren't getting paid that weekend. And so it was tough. There was only a couple seasons that, I made a little bit of money, a couple seasons I broke even. So it was tough. It was a lot of fun, and I'm sure glad I did it. And I miss it sometimes because it's just, like I said, it seems like it was a lifetime ago, but it was a lot of fun. So yeah, I think I already said, I kind of came to the hard conclusion I wasn't going to be, famous racing motorbikes. But again, I'm trying not to take up too much time talking about stuff outside the law, but just a quick funny story. So I didn't realize that people in my hometown knew who I was until it was all over. So my now wife, Jody, at the time, we started dating, and it was kind of a long distance relationship. But then she ended up moving to South Dakota for me to go to law school, and she started working at one of the hospitals as a nurse. And so people would ask her, hey, why did you come to South Dakota? And she said, well, my boyfriend is starting law school. And so I moved back here for that. And, well, who's your boyfriend? And she would tell him. And a scary number of people would say, the guy on TV racing motorcycles. And she'd be like, that's the guy. So apparently people knew just because I was local that I was doing that, but I didn't know that at the time. So that's my claim to fame right there, that people apparently knew I was racing motorcycles, but I didn't know they knew that. So,
well, that's a fair claim to fame. I dare say that there probably aren't too many who have that claim to fame. So I think that's a pretty good one. And I suppose kind of eking by and understanding that side of life probably gave you a unique viewpoint on the law and on court and justices, I suppose, right?
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I say that a lot. I think traveling around the country, meeting all kinds of people in different parts of the country, and just kind of that life experience doing that very weird thing, trying mm-hmm, to make mm-hmm. make a living racing motorcycles and traveling around. And even before that, when I was in college, I mean, and there was at one time I was working four jobs, just trying to club race and try to just have that as a hobby because it was, it's an expensive hobby. Sure. And so, yeah, I mean, I definitely have a little bit of unusual life experience. You know, I worked as a ski instructor. I worked at a ski shop, and you know, just odd things like that prior to trying to race. And then in the off season, while I was racing, I was working at a sporting goods store, just because a couple of guys that I knew owned it, and selling skis and rollerblades and stuff like that in the off season. So.
Sure. I guess I imagine that, you know, for a lot of people who come to district court, scrounging by and going to job might be a reality. So maybe it does give you a little bit of that perspective in terms of, understanding that as opposed to, you know, somebody else.
Yeah. And then
so very good.
Yeah. And then in the job at Gateway, I started as a phone tech, and,
that was
a weird job. I mean, I was kind of a computer person, you know, back mm-hmm. then. Things were a lot different. You know, everybody was calling because they couldn't connect their modem to AOL. Most people don't even know what that means anymore. I ended up getting promoted at that job pretty quickly. I was the youngest manager there briefly because I quit so I could start racing full time. but yeah, that was a fun job. I actually liked working at Gateway. It was interesting.
No, it makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. It's good to have a little bit of that perspective. You know, and I suppose, you know, when we think about how that perspective matters, I mean, going back to what we were saying about, you know, what does a person need to know to do this job? But, and also the fact that, you know, what I was saying in the intro about how partisan is this race? Because my understanding is that the answer is not very partisan at all, but maybe you have a different viewpoint on that.
Yeah. Judicial races are kind of a strange beast because everybody wants to know the answer to that question. I've attended. Well, campaign season's just kind of starting going now, So last weekend my wife and I went to the Cheney May Fest and hung out and set up a little booth and, you know, tried to talk to folks, but the weather was very bad. And I think that kept the crowds away a little bit, but there were quite a few people there, but everybody wants to know, you know, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? And frankly, in a judicial campaign, I'm not allowed to answer that. It's unethical for me to answer that question. But that's what everybody cares about because things seem very, very partisan right now. So, it's tough because you want to be able to truthfully talk to people and tell people what they, you know, what they want to know. But, when it comes to those types of things, you have to be careful.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So of course, without that party background, you know, then that begs the question of how would you differentiate yourself, from your opponent? Because in this race, you do have an opponent, is my understanding.
Yeah. I think so. And nothing's official till next week, but it certainly seems that way. So, I think I've kind of already answered that question. I frankly don't know, her, at all. I met her for the first time after all of this had started. So I don't really know her. So the only way I can really answer that question is, by telling you that, you know, the things I've done to get to this point. And I've kind of already done that. I think the only thing I haven't explained is, the things I've done since I closed down my law practice. You know, I closed my practice down, after I was appointed commissioner in district court. Prior to that, I had already been covering a conflict docket in Pendere County District Court for that judge, because it's a small court, one judge. So, you know, he had conflicts from time to time, or he'd go on vacation, things like that. He was out on an extended medical leave once upon a time. And so Pendere County basically hired me to be him while he was gone. And that started in 2014. I still cover that conflict docket today. They have a new judge that was elected four years ago with the last election cycle, Judge McCroskey. And she was one of their kind of full-time public defenders prior to becoming judge. So when she became judge, she had a ton of conflicts with the criminal cases. So when she was first brought on, I got all of those conflict cases. And so I had more criminal cases than she had for a while, but that's slowly dwindling. So I go out there about a half a day every other month now to cover those conflicts for her. But I've been doing that for a long time. And then in addition, I try to take as many conflict cases for the outlying jurisdictions when they ask, because they contact our court quite often and say, hey, you know, because Stevens County only has one district court judge. And so I've covered cases in Stevens County, Pendere County, Arroway Heights Municipal Court. I cover in Superior Court in Spokane County sometimes to fill in for the commissioners there on the family law dockets, mostly the family law dockets. And then the original commissioner appointment was part-time in 2018. And so I was also appointed as an administrative law judge by the state of Washington right about that same time. So on my days off in district court, I would do administrative appeal hearings. So I've done I've done hundreds of those at this point. And so I've on purpose, I've tried to kind of get as much judicial experience as I can in all of the different jurisdictions that I can.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, great. Yeah. It sounds like you've had a bit of a well-rounded experience for this position. You know, and I think for a lot of listeners, they would like to know, you know, what does a day look like for a judge? I mean, what is it that a judge does? Do you just kind of sit on a bench and, you know, kind of hand out dictates, or is there more to it than that?
Sometimes that's what the day is. It just depends on the day. I think most people are probably more interested in criminal matters than the civil stuff. I don't know if that's true, but I think most people are concerned with crime and that type of thing. So, you know, a lot of what we do in district court is exactly that. Half of our judges are assigned to, well, if you include first appearances, I guess more than half of our judges are assigned to criminal matters. You know, a typical day is, especially for the judges that are assigned to what we call an alpha court or an alpha docket, not only sitting in court doing those dockets, which would be, you know, hearing pretrials, sometime, you know, taking pleas and sentencing folks after they've pled guilty, but it also includes other types of things. Probation violation allegations are brought before the court. The court has to decide sometimes, one, was there a probation violation? And two, if there was, what's an appropriate sanction? And then in addition, there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that most people don't even know. And so a lot of the reviews for probation violations and things happen behind the scenes. Probation will get a hold of or kind of send a notice to the court and say, hey, we found out that this person has allegedly violated probation. And that's usually reviewed off docket in your office. And I do a lot of that when the judges are on vacation for the alpha judges. The one duty that I don't have as commissioner is the judges are kind of the top of the org chart for district court. For policy decisions with regard to the court, personnel decisions within the court, all of that ends at the judges. I don't have a vote in those things as a commissioner. I work for the judges. So I report to the judges directly. As commissioner, I do a lot of things that they ask. I do a lot of review on traffic type cases behind the scenes, just because it takes some of that off of their plate. Some of the judges will assign me stuff specifically for, say, research purposes or things. So when I have time outside of the courtroom, I work on the things that the judges ask me to work on. For example, we have, you know, pro tem judges that come in and cover when I'm not available, or one of the other judges isn't available to cover for one of the other judges. I've been tasked recently with redoing all of our training videos for the new judge pro tems. We have some training videos that we did a number of years ago. It was actually an in-person kind of training session where some of the judges gave presentations to the people that wanted to be judge pro tems. Some of those videos are kind of off topic and go off on tangents and are a little bit long. I've been trying to redo all those videos, just filming them in a courtroom on each different docket that we do. So, I'm almost done filming all of those. So, anybody out there that wants to be a new judge pro tem, their training will just be me staring into a camera, kind of describing, what to expect.
Gotcha.
But yeah, so I think all of that has just been training for me to, you know, kind of ask the voters of Spokane and Spokane Valley to hire me to be the one of the next judges that comes in.
Gotcha. It sounds like a lot of paperwork, but also videos and some cool things. I mean, is this really different than being a regular lawyer, you know, a lawyer who's trying cases, et cetera? Is there a big difference here?
Yeah. I think so. I think it's, I've talked to a number of people that have pro temmed a couple of times and they never come back. And I think it's because it's more different than people expect it to be. It sure was for me when I first started. Even something as simple as a first appearance on a criminal case, when you're an attorney, a prosecutor or a defense attorney, you've sat through, you know, literally 1,000 first appearances in your legal career. So, right. So you put the robe on and you sit up on the bench and you think, geez, how hard could it be to do a first appearance? And it's much harder than you think it's going to be, because your mindset has to be completely different when you're not advocating for one side or the other. You are the neutral party and you are the one that makes the decision. For example, in a first appearance, you know, does that person get to go home or is that person going to stay in jail? Those are heavy decisions sometimes. And, I joke with my friends sometimes, and maybe I shouldn't say this publicly, but I will. I used to joke with my friends that after I became a judicial officer, that I was never a very good lawyer because, I was never very good at taking one side just super hard. I was always the one that wanted everybody to get along, and I wanted to be the one that here's the right decision. I don't care if I'm on this side or that side. I always wanted to find the right decision. And that's not the best way for a lawyer to handle a case oftentimes, because you need to advocate for whatever side you're hired to be on or whatever side you're on, you know, wholeheartedly. And I was always very bad at that. Gotcha. I couldn't buy all into a side I didn't believe in, even if it was the side I was being paid to be on. And that's why I think my personality fits my current role, and hopefully my role as judge probably better than it ever did as being a lawyer.
Gotcha. So I guess that kind of answers the next question. Is there a pretty big difference between a good lawyer and a good judge? It's that kind of that ability to take both sides and to look at both aspects of a case.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that a really good lawyer can't be a really good judge. That's not where I'm going with that. I'm just saying I used to always joke about that for myself, is that, that I was bad at it just because I always wanted everybody to be right. I wanted the right decision to be made no matter what. And so, I used to joke about that.
Well, no, that actually makes a lot of sense. But of course, for our listeners, they'd really like to know, you know, how do you, I mean, you talked about that example of on a first appearance, you know, how do you personally weigh those things? I mean, you know, how are you going to look at sentencing?
Yeah. I can tell you that even now I make bail decisions and release decisions on a weekly basis. And it's hard sometimes. I think about it a lot. They're very difficult decisions sometimes. You know, some people are going to say in district court, you're just dealing with misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. You're not dealing with felonies. You know, you're not dealing with somebody that's charged with, you know, a very, very serious crime. And for the most part, that's true. We do first appearances in district court on felonies sometimes, but in Washington state, it's relatively rare. And in Spokane County, it's relatively rare. Prosecutors will file felonies in district court sometimes for certain reasons, but it doesn't happen that often. So I have done first appearances on felonies here in district court, but it doesn't happen that often. But I think the main thing that people need to understand, I think, is, you know, my goal is to always follow the law. That's kind of number one. And with regard to release decisions, you know, our criminal court rule 3.2 lays that out for us. That's what I have to take into consideration when somebody's before me. And like I said, you know, a lot of the stuff we see in first appearances are relatively minor, but, the most serious things that we deal with in district court are domestic violence cases, because we get lots, assault fourth degrees, domestic violence. We get no contact order violations, and some other miscellaneous, domestic violence types cases, but those are the main ones. And then obviously we get lots of, DUIs. And so those are the two most serious things that we generally deal with in district court. There are some other, misdemeanor sex crimes, but they don't get charged out that often. Rarely. I think I've maybe seen two of those cases in the 4 years I've been on the bench there. So it doesn't happen that often. And so the things that we're supposed to take into consideration in the state of Washington, the Washington State Supreme Court has said the presumption is always release, unless certain things are shown. And those things are, does this person have a history of not showing up for court? So do we think that they will fail to appear if we release them? So that's number one. Number two is, do we believe that they would commit a violent crime if they were to be released? And then number three is, would this person interfere with the administration of justice if they were to be released? And that could include, tampering with witnesses. So that comes into play quite often in DV cases. Do we think that this person would try to contact the victim in the case? And those are the three things that we're supposed to take into consideration. And so we hear from the state, we hear from the defense attorney. I have certain tools available to me on the bench. I can review people's criminal history. I can review their fail to appear history and make a decision as to whether they get to leave or not. And so they are very difficult decisions, especially considering, somebody that's just been released on, say, a domestic violence assault, and now a week later they're accused of violating that protection order that was issued when they were released on the assault. And so a lot of times it comes down to the facts of the case itself. So I have to take those facts and kind of fit them into those factors and make a decision on each of those cases. And if I'm being honest, I mean, it's not easy sometimes. And so those same kind of things go into sentencing decisions. I'm sure you're aware. I think most of your listeners are probably aware, if they follow these types of things, that when somebody pleads guilty, especially in district court, there's usually some type of an agreement or an offer that the court is told about. So, the parties have negotiated the case. The defendant's going to plead to, the charge or maybe something else as part of the agreement. They've been told that the offer is, X number of days in jail, X number of months on probation. There's going to be some fees and costs and things usually. And then that's what they think's going to happen. But when you're sitting there on the bench, you don't have to follow that. And so one of the things that you always warn them about is, here's the maximum sentence. Here's what the offer is. This is my understanding. Is this your understanding? I also have to warn you that once you plead guilty, I don't necessarily have to abide by this offer, and I could impose up to that maximum sentence. Do you still want to enter a plea today? So it is pretty unusual to stray away from the offer. And what I generally say is, the attorneys know more about these cases than I do. I just learn a little bit at the plea. And so I have to give a lot of discretion and a lot of deference to the negotiations. So when the state's attorney tells me, here's what the state's recommending, and the defense attorney saying, yep, that's what we negotiated, I just ask that the court go along with it. Most of the time, I think in most courtrooms that happens. And so then it kind of puts the ball in the court's court, because then the person's on probation. And then if there's allegations of probation violations, then the court has a bit more discretion. Well, I shouldn't say that. The court has a lot of discretion with sentencing too, but the ball kind of gets into our court when it comes to probation decisions. So you're kind of giving those defendants, hey, here's the deal. You're going to be on probation for a while. If you get in trouble, you're going to come back and see us, and then things are going to get, kind of progressively worse for you. I
gotcha.
I kind of went off on a tangent there. I apologize.
No, it's a great tangent. And I think exactly the kind of thing that the listeners want to know. And I suppose within all of this, you also have to balance out victims' rights against defendants' rights. And I know that there's some written guidance on that, but I think a lot of listeners would like to know, you know, how do you personally take that balance?
Yeah, I think, again, in district court, it's usually the domestic violence cases where we would have a victim that would want to say something at sentencing. That doesn't happen very often in district court. It's much more common in superior court when people are mm-hmm. being convicted of more serious cases, mm-hmm. even theft cases. You know, when I used to practice law in district court, our theft cases are usually, you know, shoplifting, you know, relatively minor things. In superior right. court, your theft cases could be, you know, somebody that embezzled millions of dollars from some nonprofit organization, or, you know, where there's some, you know, some serious detriment to the victim in the case.
Right.
And so a lot of times you would have victim statements, even in those types of cases in superior court, but in district court, you know, the only time I'm trying to think, maybe one other case other than a domestic violence case I've ever had, a victim statement. I just had one yesterday. I covered, we do what we call felony reductions or remands, where people were originally charged with felonies, but they're going to plead to a misdemeanor. So then that comes back down to district court for them to enter the plea to the misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. And so I covered that docket yesterday, and we had a pretty serious domestic violence case. And the gentleman's wife was in the courtroom and wanted to make a statement. So of course I'm going to let her say whatever she wants to tell me. And they hadn't had any contact for quite some time because there'd been a pretrial domestic violence, no contact order as part of the superior mm-hmm. court case. And so it had been, let's see, May, almost 6 months since they'd had any contact, it sounded like. And she didn't want me to issue a post-conviction no contact order because she said, it's been a long time. We'd like to start rebuilding our relationship. And so the state was still asking that I impose a no contact order post conviction because the allegations in the assault were relatively serious. The gentleman that pled guilty had no prior criminal history at all, which is sometimes unusual in a domestic violence case, but not always. Mm-hmm. And so what I told her was, you know, the no contact orders don't have to be either all or nothing, you know. I can allow some contact, but not all contact, because I think people and victims in those cases think that a no contact order is a no contact order. It's either I can have all contact or I can have no contact, but that's not the case. I can fashion the order so that you can have some contact. How about no direct contact, but you guys can start talking on the phone again. And then that way I'm confident that you're safe because my order still prevents him from contacting you directly, but the two of you can start talking on the phone and maybe start to work things out. And then we can kind of step that no contact order down, or I guess step that contact up as things progress. Gotcha. And so her and I just talked about that on the record yesterday after he had pled guilty. And I think she thought that was a good idea. So that's what we ended up doing in that case. That's just one example. Like I said, in district court, we don't really hear from victims directly that often. But
it does happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it does, it sounds like it's like that Solomon splitting the baby sort of thing, huh?
Yeah, and honestly, that wasn't what I was trying to do. I mean, I want to do what she wants me to do, but at the same time, I want her to be safe. Right. And again, the allegations in that case were pretty serious, maybe more serious than we normally see in district court. And so, you know, if she's going to contact him outside of the no contact order, I mean, I don't have any control over that, but it sounds like, at least according to her, that he had been abiding by the no contact order over the last 5 months, which, again, is maybe, I hate to say it, is maybe a little unusual sometimes in these cases. I think people probably violate those orders a lot because they want to try to start rebuilding their relationships. All I can do is hope that people abide by the court's orders. But there'd been no allegations that he had violated. And she told me yesterday, you know, when I was talking to her, that he hadn't violated it. So I believe what she told me. We hear from victims indirectly, you know, through the state, sure. sometimes through mm-hmm. the domestic violence advocates that are involved in these cases, or the victims' advocates that are involved in these cases. And I always want to try to empower the the victims in those cases, and I want to do what they want me to do, but at the same time, I want to make sure they're safe. And I don't always think I know better than them, but I've seen enough of these to see how they play out sometimes. And the domestic violence cases, in my opinion, are by far the hardest and scariest and most serious things that we deal with in district court. And it's hard to get a handle on it sometimes, because we see the same people over and over and over again. And I know that's frustrating for law enforcement because they see the same couples over and over and over again. And then they look to us to try to fix it, but it's tough. Right. you hear about the revolving door, the revolving jail door. These folks get arrested over and over again and they keep reoffending. And those are tough questions to answer.
Yeah. And that is a question I think I'll be asking you here in just a moment. So I'm glad you bring it up. But before we get there, I think it's important for a lot of folks to kind of know, you've really covered some really great examples and talked about, balancing the scales here. But I think it's important for people to know, how do you balance the scale between the need to do all of these things and all these different pieces and the need to get reelected? Is that a scale to balance?
So that's something I've never really had to deal with because I can tell you as commissioner, it's never once crossed my mind that if I make a certain decision that I think might be unpopular, that I have to worry about repercussions with the voters. Because as commissioner, I'm not elected. I'm appointed by the judges and I work for them. And so it's just something I've never really had to think about too much. I hope I don't start thinking about it. I don't want to think about it. I want to make the right decision or what I believe to be the right decision, whether it's popular or unpopular, because that's my job. It doesn't matter if I'm an elected judge or not. I'm elected to make the right decision. The voters are trusting me to do that. And sometimes those decisions might not be popular. I think in district court, we're maybe a little bit insulated from that because we're not necessarily dealing with, very, very, hot and heavy issues oftentimes. We're not making decisions with regard to, very controversial social policies and things that the appellate courts have to deal with. Sometimes the superior courts have to deal with, and obviously the Supreme Court has to deal with. But at the same time, there has been blowback in district courts around the state when, decisions are made that especially in a smaller community that isn't popular. I can tell you about one example in a case that I covered in Pendre County. There was an elected official that had filed for a protection order against really just a citizen. The citizen was kind of I would call an activist. Maybe he was very involved in local politics up there. And so this was big news up in Newport that this this politician had filed for this protection order. And so because of the petitioner's status up in that community, the judge recused herself and it became my case. So I'm the visiting judge basically to hear the case. And so it was in the paper more than once. It was in the news. But like I said, I think I probably did cross my mind knowing that no matter what I decided, it was going to end up in the news and the paper up there was going to say, Judge Pro Tem Doima says this, that, and the other thing. So I knew it was going to end up in the paper. So, I did a couple things a little differently. I took the case under advisement, which is really unusual for a protection order case. Generally, you're going to make a decision right after you hear testimony. The other unusual thing was the hearing was
for our folks at home. Taking a case under advisement means you hear the case and then you take some time to make your decision. It means you don't just say it right off, right at the docket, just like, okay, I've heard you guys, here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. So generally in protection order cases, you're going to hear from both sides. You're going to review all the documents that were submitted and you're going to make a decision right then and there after you hear from the folks. To take it under advisement means I'm not making a decision today. You're going to hear from me in a week. and I'm going to get issue a written decision usually. Right. So that's what under advisement means, right? So that hearing was very long. The police chief testified. It was very newsworthy up there.
All the important people in town.
So yeah, yeah. Everybody was following it. So the clerk's office had told me that people had been calling and they wanted transcripts of the hearings and all of this. So we had the hearing. I think it ended up being 3 hours or some crazy long hearing for a protection order hearing. And I knew that it was kind of emotionally charged because there was a controversial issue up there. This is way off topic, but there was a smelter.
No, this is great.
There was a smelter that was going to go in up on the river up there, and that was very controversial. You know, lots of people were very, very against it.
Still is controversial, from what I know.
Yeah, yeah, as far as I know, I don't know this to be true, but I as far as I know, I think it's pretty much dead at this point. But I don't think it's going forward anymore. But the gentleman that was the respondent in the protection order, he if I remember right, he was very much against the smelter, and that was part of how people knew who he was. He was this activist. We had this very long hearing. I took it under advisement. I wrote a decision, which again is unusual in a protection order case, and I knew it was going to be cut and paste into the newspaper. So I was very careful about how I wrote the decision. So that was a very long way to answer your question about, you know, do you think about, you know, who's going to like your decision and who's not going to like your decision? When it comes to the decision itself, no, that never crossed my mind when I made a decision in that case. I actually thought my decision was going to be pretty unpopular in that case, but it was surprised. What I ended up doing was I ended up denying the protection order. I didn't think there was enough there to grant a protection order for the elected official. But because of that, I thought there might be a little pushback or some blowback because I was disagreeing with the elected official up there, but everything turned out fine. I had even heard from both parties had attorneys, which again is a little bit unusual in a protection order case. So it was, right. It was hotly contested, you should say. I ended up denying the protection order. I think that was the headline in the paper, that the protection order was denied after I had sent my decision up there. But, again, for district court, that's a little unusual to have something so much in the news, but. So I can tell you that knowing all of that going into it and knowing all of that when I wrote the decision had no bearing on the decision itself. It did have some bearing on probably the words I chose and how I put those words together in my decision. To get back to the original question, I hope as an elected judge that doesn't affect my decision because it certainly shouldn't. I'm always going to want to follow the law. I'm always going to want to fit the facts into the law and make the best decision that I can with the information that I have at the time. Whether I think that decision is popular or unpopular really should have no bearing on it. That's not why you're elected as a judge. You're elected to make the best decision you can. I always say right decision, but I mean right decision based on what you know, the best decision. It might not always be the right decision. I'm certainly wrong sometimes, but I try not to be.
Well, that makes I think that was a great way to answer the question. And I guess in a way it kind of feeds into this next piece. You brought up the revolving door of justice and kind of the things that people are hearing, the rumors that people are hearing, that the jails are just being turned open and the judges are just walking people out and saying please go on. And I've been doing a lot of interviews on this particular topic with different pieces of the judicial area, whether it be the sheriff or the prosecuting attorney, etc. And there has been some pointing to that being the case. Would you say that rising crime here in Spokane and Spokane County has a lot to do with judicial discretion, and if so, how would you respond to that?
It's That's a tough question because I hear different numbers from different parties that disagree quite a bit. You know, even the rise in crime numbers is controversial. I can tell you that we probably, I mean, I think everybody knows if you've been reading the paper because of COVID, we kind of did mm-hmm. open the jails. When COVID first kind of hit, all of the jurisdictions, Muni Court, District Court, Superior Court, were under a lot of pressure to let as many people out of the jail as possible because everybody was worried COVID was going to go crazy in the jails and kill a bunch of people. And so the main goal was to, we didn't want people dying in the jail. And so the jail was putting a lot of pressure on all of us to let as many people out as we could. And so in district court, the alpha judges, they reviewed all of their kind of pretrial detainees and decided who could go and who had to stay. And I know municipal court and superior court did the same thing. And I don't know the exact numbers, but I know a lot of people were released when those reviews were done by the three local jurisdictions. And so I knew the numbers once upon a time, but I don't remember them off the top of my head. But a lot of people got released. But I know now we're pretty much back up to pre-COVID incarceration numbers at the county jail.
Right.
And so, I don't really know why or the correlation. I know that, again, we talked about it just a little while ago, when it comes to release decisions, you know, I'm bound to follow the law. I do have discretion when it comes to holding people or not holding people pre-trial. But at the same time, I'm not going to substitute, you know, my feelings or what I think about a certain individual. I'm not going to substitute that for the court rule. I have to follow the court rule no matter what. And in Washington State, again, that rule is pretty much everybody gets released unless certain factors are met. And in misdemeanor cases, sometimes it's hard to meet those factors. I think that, again, the DV cases are the ones maybe that are the exception because, like the example I gave earlier, somebody was just released on an assault and now there's already an allegation that they've violated the no contact order. Maybe it's the second time they've allegedly violated the no contact order. So those are situations where in district court, you're probably not going to get released on your own recognizance anymore. But a lot of the other cases, unless you have a very long history of failing to appear, which is common in district court cases, even on very, very minor cases. But the other side of that coin is a lot of those folks struggle financially. They struggle with homelessness.
Right.
They're not necessarily missing court because they want to miss court. They don't have a phone. They have no transportation. So there are a lot of other factors that people miss court on, sometimes very, you know, minor charges. And if they would just show up for court, the case would get resolved relatively quickly. They would go on with their life and it would be behind them.
Right.
But, you know, warrants get issued because they miss court. We don't really have I'm not going to call it a program, but a lot of times if somebody misses court on a minor charge, we don't issue a warrant the first time. We'll send a kind of a second chance notice. Hey, you missed court. You know, here's a new court date. If you don't come the next time, we're probably going to have to issue a warrant. And then we'll do an address search and see if we can track down a different address. I usually will look through the DOL information right on the bench to see if the DOL has a different address than we used when we sent the original notice. We try, and the clerk's office will try to call people sometimes if we get returned mail. But again, yep. A lot of folks, you know, they don't have a good phone number. So unfortunately, a lot of times warrants get issued simply because we cannot find any other way to contact these folks. I can tell you that I don't feel good about it. I don't want to issue a warrant because you didn't come to court. You didn't know you had court.
Right.
But we've tried everything we can. A warrant will get issued with a small amount of bond, depending on the charge itself. There is a general order that the jail has from our court that if people are picked up on certain types of cases or certain types of warrants, the jail just books and releases them before they see one of us. And so that's some of kind of the revolving door is the jail doesn't necessarily want to take up a bed with these folks that, you know, frankly, probably would come to court if they knew they had court, or with very minor cases, you know, maybe a shoplifting or a criminal trespass because someone was found, you know, sleeping on a bench or something like that. We used to have a lot of driver's license cases. Some of those are kind of dwindling because of a change in the law. But we used to have tons and tons of warrants on driver's license cases. Some of that has been, I guess, stymied through other means, just because the legislature has changed how those are handled. But yeah, I think the revolving door issue, I don't want to throw another jurisdiction under the bus, but, you know, the more serious cases do end up in Superior Court, and I don't know how those decisions are made there. The other cases we have are the DUIs, obviously, and certainly we get the folks that have multiple DUIs. And so the argument's made that they shouldn't be out there driving at all. And so we have some other tools that we try to use, pretrial alcohol monitoring or drug monitoring. I don't know. I think most people are aware that there's kind of the blow and go device called the ignition interlock device that has to be installed right. in people's cases. And that's by statute under certain circumstances. The court has no discretion. If people have a certain criminal history, you know, the court has to order that ignition interlock device. If they're not driving because their car was broken or they crashed, or they don't have a driver's license, so they shouldn't be driving, which was pretty common. Then the statute requires that the court impose some type of alcohol monitoring beyond the ignition interlock device. And I know that the judges in district court, and including myself, I mean, we always make sure that happens, and then we try to monitor as best we can if they're following through, because we get notices from the agencies that we use for these devices whether they signed up or not. And if they right. if they don't, we bring them right back into court to explain themselves. Why didn't you follow through with testing? Why didn't you install the ignition interlock device? And one of the options we have is to revoke their release if they're not going to comply with the pretrial order. And so we kind of always have that, I guess, stick on, you know, hey, if you're not going to stop drinking and driving, we have no choice but to put you back in jail. The Washington State Supreme Court, is for the court rules purposes, has said that DUI is not a violent offense when it comes to release decisions. And so you'll have people that may have, you know, multiple DUIs, but I'm not allowed to consider that when it comes to release decisions because it's not considered a violent offense. I can consider the totality of their, I guess, criminal history, but a lot of times those people, that's all they've ever had is, you know, these drinking offenses. They've never had any other, you know, serious violent crime or a felony of any kind. The DUIs turn into a felony someday, but that takes a lot to get there. So
right.
I think I've gone off on enough of a tangent here that I've forgotten the original question, but
I mean, essentially, you know, like if this is causing crime, and I suppose, you know, in some of your answer, I think we've pointed a little bit at the legislature, at a few of these things that may lock your hands in terms of how to deal with some of these different offenses.
Yeah. And I mean, and frankly, when I'm sitting there, I mean, I can kind of do what I think is best, but I always have to frame that on the court rule. I mean, I have to follow the court rule, and the court rule requires me to make findings on the record if I'm not going to release somebody. I have to give an explanation as to why isn't this person getting released. And so I have to justify it not only to myself, but I have to justify it to the record. You know, here's why this person isn't being released on this case. And really in district court, the main reason that people get held is because they have a long history of not coming back to court. And so, you know, hey, I know if I release you today, we're not going to see you again until you get picked up on the next warrant. And that's pretty common.
Right.
But again, like we just talked about, the other side of that coin is some of that's outside of folks' control sometimes, because of other circumstances in their life. And so, you know, I try to be as thoughtful as I can and as sympathetic as I can to those situations. But ultimately the cases have to get resolved somehow, some way.
Right.
And, sometimes that means you're going to have to sit in jail for a week or two until you can be seen and by a judge that's assigned to the case. At that point, chances are you're going to get credit for that time and the case would be resolved with that. And so, you know, even if you're held pre-trial, that detention is relatively short-lived.
Minor.
Yeah. I mean, you can't put everybody in jail for a year, on every misdemeanor. And so a lot of those misdemeanors, especially if somebody ends up in custody because they failed to appear over and over again, they're going to get, you know, whatever credit they have by the time they end up at their pretrial. And sometimes that's a week, sometimes that's a month. I mean, it just depends, but that usually resolves the case. And then they're released at that point. So, so that detention, I mean, is sad as it is to say, sometimes in a lot of cases that detention's, it's very temporary.
Well, I think we definitely covered that one. I think the last question that I think a lot of folks would like to know about, because another big piece of being a judge is the committees that you may or may not apply to. And I think that it's important to note that these committees, that they are very important because they set, you know, precedent and policy for how the judiciary operates throughout Washington State. And being a part of those committees is really important because you, as a judge from Spokane, being on that committee can make sure to represent Spokane issues. So I suppose I would ask, what committees do you see yourself applying for, being a part of, and why?
So I'm on two of those committees already. I'm a member of the District Court Municipal Judges Association because I'm the District Court Commissioner, and so I'm on the Council for Independent Courts. And I'm also on the public outreach committee for the DC MJA. And so the public outreach committee that I'm on, we meet about once a month. And it's mostly really, it sounds silly, but mostly we're trying to help jurisdictions with just some social media outreach, because it's always this fine line about should the court have a Facebook page, you know, because,
right,
you know, the courts all around the state have to be very careful about the information that they put out because there's this very fine line about looking to be biased one way or the other. And so,
you mean you guys shouldn't just put like memes on your Facebook
page? Right. Like, you know? you can't
the courtroom memes.
Yeah. You can't put funny memes about something that happened in court or even posting a true story about what happened in court. That could be controversial too, because it could be seen as taking a side. And so, it's all very, I guess, tightrope walky, you know? And so the other big thing that the public outreach committee does is we have a legislative liaison that we talk to. And then she's always kind of keeping us updated with potential legislation that's coming through. And if there's anything that we think we need to comment on, and if we need to reach out to other judges in our jurisdiction to reach out to their legislature, or if we know any legislators personally, if we should be reaching out and saying, hey, we have some concerns about this or that. And so that's the other thing that we're kind of keeping track of as part of that committee. The Council on Independent Courts is actually a pretty interesting committee for me to be on. I enjoy it. We don't get involved in too many things, but we just had a little background maybe for the listeners, because I always kind of forget that people don't maybe know the ins and outs of things. But there's a lot of part-time judges in the state of Washington.
And those are the pro tems, as we said.
No, there's actual judges that are part-time. There's district court judges that are part-time.
You mean as in like a judge, but then sometimes they might be a lawyer. They don't have to be,
they just don't get paid full-time, like a full judge's salary. So even Lincoln County, if I'm remembering correctly, Lincoln County's judge is 80% of a judge. He gets paid 80%. He gets paid 80% of the judge's salary, but because he's part-time, he's allowed to practice law if he wanted to. And I know he was for a while. And Pondere County's district court judge used to be part-time, but it sounds like they now have enough business up there that it's full-time. But the main one, the main judges that I'm talking about are municipal court judges. There are a lot of small municipalities and cities around the state of Washington that have a part-time judge. Airway Heights is a good example. Mm. So Airway Heights in Spokane County has a part-time judge. And so the issues that come up with that are very interesting because, you have a part-time judge that has full-time staff. And so that judge is the kind of the department head by state law. And that part-time judge has by law, certain responsibilities, hiring and firing responsibilities, disciplinary responsibilities when it comes to court staff. But it might not surprise you to think that the mayor's office or the city council often thinks that that's their job. And so there's a lot of headbutting sometimes between these part-time courts and the city government. And so that's what the Council on Independent Courts does, is we get involved in those situations when there's some question about who's overreaching. I don't know if you remember reading about it, but there was a municipality over on the west side recently that was having some issues with their city government and their judge were arguing about who controls the court staff. And so we as a committee, we had sent a couple letters to the mayor and gotten involved in that a little bit. And I actually think the Council on Independent Courts ended up helping resolve that situation. The judge had actually sued the city in Superior Court over there because she was saying that the city had overreached and were taking away statutory duties of hers. And so she wanted the Superior Court to decide if that was true or not. That case ended up getting dismissed because they ended up working it out, which should happen. I mean,
right.
So that committee is actually very interesting, even though we're not involved in things that often,
that makes a lot of sense. So we're really talking about the separation of branches here,
between
the judicial and the executive branch and how you may have staff members who might by all appearances, be part of say the executive branch, i.e. they might look like city staff, but in fact they're part of the judicial branch.
Right.
So I guess that's where the bleed kind of comes in.
Well, and it's confusing. I get it. You know, their paychecks come from the city. It doesn't necessarily come from the court. So that, you know, it is strange. And I know that, I think sometimes I'm just speculating here. And again, this is kind of a little off what we're talking about, but I'm sure it's a little strange to be a part-time employee as a part-time judge, but you supervise all of these full-time staff members. And so I think I would imagine from the staff's perspective, that's a little strange and it's gotta be a little strange from the judge's perspective too. But that's just how they're set up because they only have a budget to pay a judge part-time because they want to have their own court, which is great. You know, there are other options. I mean, a good example in Spokane County is Cheney. Cheney has its own court, but they contract with us. And so one of our district court judges acts as the Cheney Municipal Court judge as part of his district court judge duties because they've contracted with the district court. And so that's another option that a lot of municipalities use. I mean, that's no different than the city of Spokane Valley, right? You know, they contract with the district court. A huge part of our business is Spokane Valley cases. I personally spend a lot of time at the Spokane Valley Courthouse. Doing the traffic docket out there. And we do, I think right now we do every other week, small claims cases in the Valley. And I cover those dockets quite regularly. So I'm out there, not every week, but very regularly.
Often.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. That is an interesting committee. And I think, a lot of folks would appreciate to hear more about that committee at some point. But with that, I think we're winding down here, and I would love to give you the last word to speak directly to the voters.
Oh, geez. I guess if I had the last word, all I would really say is I truly believe that I'm asking the voters of Spokane County to hire me for an important job, and as you pointed out, kind of at the beginning. unfortunately, people don't know judges. It's just a fact. We all get it. I always say that if you grab somebody off the street and ask them to name one of the 8 district court judges, they probably wouldn't be able to do it. And it's because of, for that reason, judicial elections in general are kind of a strange beast. I'm just trying to get the word out there that I'm running for district court judge. I've done really everything that I think I can as an attorney and as a judicial officer to have the most varied experience that I can. I've done a number of different things as an attorney and as a judge. I've covered in a number of different jurisdictions as a judge or a commissioner. I've handled all kinds of different cases. I've handled literally thousands and thousands of district court cases in 3 different district courts in the state of Washington at this point. I do that every day as part of my job as commissioner. And I'm simply asking the voters to look at that experience and those things that I've done to get here, to ask them to hire me for that job. I look at this as just a big job interview, and the voters are the ones that decide who gets hired. And all I can do is put my resume out there and tell the voters that I work every day to keep training for that job. That's literally how I look at commissioner. I'm a judge trainee, even though I kind of do the job now. I just don't have the executive authority that the judges have. I've attended the state of Washington's Judicial College that's required when I was appointed commissioner. I've attended countless judicial trainings since I've been commissioner. I work very hard every day to be the best judicial officer I can. And I just hope that the voters see that.
Very good. Very good. Well, with that, Mr. Duyma, I'd really like to thank you for coming on Spokane Valley Speaks and speaking directly to our voters here. And for those at home, for our listeners at home who listen to this program, if Spokane Valley Speaks is a program that speaks to you, that helps you in your daily life, that helps you make these crucial decisions, please review our podcast, make sure you rate our podcast, and make sure you're sharing the podcast and telling friends and family about this here in town, because we've got a lot of important decisions coming up. And I think that Spokane Valley Speaks is your best resource for communicating directly with your candidates. So with that, we'll see you on the next episode. Thank you very much. Boy, prices are sure getting out of control. That being said, there is an upside. This is a great time to make investments. And what better investment than investing in your own business ideas? I started Spokane Startups to give people like you a leg up in starting a business here in Spokane. I understand that startup costs are one of the hardest parts of starting a business, so I offer all of my support on a pay what it's worth model. So give me a call today and let me see what I can do to help you make your dreams come true. 509-315-6416 or SpokaneStartups.com. 509-315-6416. Spokane Startups, helping you start businesses today.